correcting anybody's Einstein, but the words are these. Great spirits have always encountered violent opposition from mediocre minds. I cannot help but this comes to mind repeatedly when dealing with the dogmatism of epidemiology in relation to screening, where, by the way, screening in epidemiological thought is thought to be preventive medicine when it is early diagnosis rather than prevention. And so much is amiss around. So that makes me unhappy. But at the same time, the progress of the research has been gratifying. And the people involved with semi-annual international conferences and so on have all been very, very committed.
When you spoke earlier of JIC, you spoke of pharmacoepidemiology. And a number of young epidemiologists that I've talked to, they shy away from pharmacoepidemiology on the grounds that one is too easily corrupted by industry and by government money as well. What would you say to them, these young people?
Well, first of all, I appreciate your question where you refer to students as worrying about corruption by government.
Mm-hmm.
This is not very well appreciated that National Institutes of Health in the United States has all sorts of policies emanating from the institutes themselves, mm-hmm. such as randomized trials in diagnostics,
mm-hmm.
Radiologic diagnostics in particular, cancer diagnostics. So government can be profoundly misguided and misleading, therefore, researchers and industry, of course, is well known in this respect. My view is that I don't care who pays for your research. I care of what you say, what your evidence is. To me, it is totally irrelevant who sponsored your research. The question is, tell me about the research rather than about the sponsorship.
So, in general, you think it's possible then for epidemiologists and biostatisticians to tread that fine line between truth and money?
No. If there is somebody sponsoring your pursuit of truth, mm-hmm. whether it is industry or government, and whatever may be their corrupt ideas bothers me not in the least, so long as you stay on the straight and narrow.
Mm-hmm. And you think that's possible?
Oh, yeah.
I expect that you've been approached many times yourself by lawyers and industry types for paid advice on matters epidemiologic. And how do you decide whether, and if you do, which ones to get involved in?
Oftentimes, sometimes half a dozen lawyers come to my office at Harvard,
mm-hmm.
And of course also here, including, by the way, tobacco people. No, I don't get involved in these things.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't particularly mind answering questions for them again to make whatever they care to make of. But that's not really their concern. They want you to be in person there in a court of law.
Mm-hmm.
And I just refrain from that totally, have never appeared in court.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I stay out of it.
I see. Now, going back now to another main topic, whom would you regard as the two or three most important epidemiologists during your lifetime?
I take it that the question is about epidemiological research rather than epidemiological practice of community
yeah.
medicine. If I were asked about all time instead of my lifetime,
mm-hmm.
then I would say very obviously Edward Jenner and Robert Koch, the principal epidemiological scientists. But if you ask about my, as you do, about my actual lifetime, mm-hmm. then I would say, sort of a little bit uncertain, but I would say, how about Franz Müller and Richard Dahl and Ernst Winder in different roles? Franz Müller, 1939, publishes his medical thesis and beautifully demonstrates how very high is the risk of lung cancer from smoking. The epidemic was well recognized as being on the ascendancy from the beginning of the century, but for once it was understood that smoking is the explanation of the epidemic. Now, Richard Dahl had a major role in retarding the understanding of this in the UK, and Winder and others in the United States similarly had a role in retarding this understanding. It was only in 1964 that the Smoking and Health Report of the Surgeon General in the United States came out, and even that wasn't all that readily received. So, notably, my own professor of epidemiology was on the committee, and he was smoking 2 packs a day, but he said, so long as the committee work is incomplete, I will not change my smoking habits, so as to not give a hint of what the results are. Notice, still uncertain, looking to what the truth is. And then when actually the report came out, he cold turkey went from 2 packs to zero and stayed at zero. But the professor of biostatistics, Pete Behrman, put a poster on his wall saying, it has now been proven beyond any reasonable doubt that smoking is the main cause of statistics. Yeah. I'm just saying that in the mid-60s, still, there was right. this thing. And as you know, your R.A. Fisher spent his sunset years trying to show that smoking does not cause lung cancer. So there was a tremendous slowness in the countries in the post-war period mm-hmm. in accepting what was well shown and quite obvious before the war.
You're the first one I've heard to say that Dahl and Winder retarded it. My understanding is that the industry was the one who kept the controversy alive for as long as they could. Why do you say Dahl?
Winder, for instance, in 1950, still concludes that it looks as though there could be an effect, but there was nothing of the sort of obvious major effect in 1950 as published by Winder, for instance. Now, Dahl in 1950 was a bit ahead of this, but still not ready to declare that there is a major, major effect on risk of lung cancer. Mm. So that there was, and by the way, he visited Germany in the 30s, Dahl did, mm-hmm. and knew as to what was going on. And replicating Müller's study would have been a quick thing to do, but no, you get into these very long-term, very massive studies, and you have to wait for years and this and that. It was apparently, as far as I can tell, really a slowing, retarding process. Whether intentional, I can't say.
Yeah, yeah. He did reference, he referenced the German work, I think, indirectly, didn't he, in the first paper?
I think he did. I can't say, but it was, actually, the abstract was published in JAMA in 1939.
Oh, okay.
Already.
But I do remember one of the statements there was maybe it's air pollution, maybe it's the tarmac atom, maybe it's this new asphalt we're putting down. That was one of
them. There were these ideas. Yeah. And as you know, the lung cancer topic was being closed in 1964 in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah.
it was remarkably slow. Mm-hmm. And as I say, my professor was smoking two packs a day. Mm-hmm.
So we're talking here about epidemiology scientists, as you say, that you'd regard as the most important. Besides yourself, who would you regard as the most important teachers of theoretical epidemiology? Do you see any others worthy of that name?
I have no notion to the effect that I am the preeminent teacher. I am probably the most experienced. Mm-hmm. Taught more courses internationally than anybody else. Mm-hmm. But I'm not saying that I am the number one teacher from the content point of view. But I, again, am not familiar with what the teachings are in the other courses. And so I just don't know who the top teachers in the aggregate are.
Yeah. No, I don't mean teachers in the classroom sense. I mean in the writer sense.
Oh, do you mean developers or textbook authors?
Yeah, textbook authors. Yeah, that type of teacher. Yeah.
Now, as you would agree, the leading teacher today in textbook terms and even as for coursework, probably clearly is my student Rothman. Mm-hmm. As for his teachings in the sense of his writings,
yeah,
I find it interesting that he still has cohort study and case control study, which in my view should be themes of the past. They do not deserve to be presented as modern ideas about epidemiological research. So there is a certain stagnancy there, lack of moving with the understandings.
Now, to come on to your own work, which do you think has been your most influential paper?
This ties up with the very question you just asked. Mm-hmm. If I need to pick one, it really should be probably that 1976 paper on case reference studies, a citation classic it is. And the eminence of it insofar as influence is concerned is perhaps principally because of the test-based interval estimate concept that was presented there. But I might add, the question there is about under-evaluated studies. And I think this is the most under-evaluated studies, under-appreciated study, really, in that there, the case-control study concept should have had the beginning of its end, but it didn't. In that paper, it is said, as a novelty, that the so-called control group really should be understood to be a sample of the study base. And once it is a sample of the study base, which is the referent of the study result, study base is the referent, why now then? You don't compare your case series with your base series. You get numerator information from one and denominator information from the other, and you get to quasi rates and their ratios without any rare disease assumption and all this. So again, to repeat, this is what the world has not yet learned, that the idea of comparing cases with controls is not what really should be done. One should understand that you need a numerator series and a denominator series, and you don't compare them. No, you derive rate ratios from them without any need for rare disease assumption. So case control study should be passé by now. And by the way, confounding, which is the alternative to causation, as you so well know. The Surgeon General's report did not yet have the word confounding there in 1964. But I say, when confounding is the alternative to causality, confounding can never be understood without the concept of study base. If you have case group and control group, and now the question is, what's a confounder? There is no answer to that question. An author of a textbook on case control studies was in my office, and I asked him, hey, how did you define confounding in your textbook? And there was a pause, and then I don't remember. I had the thought quietly that it's difficult to remember something that makes no sense. Case control study is an aberration that really should disappear. And there's something aberrant about cohort study as well. So stagnation prevails also in the theory of epidemiological research.
Just to read into the record here as well, another person who got it right, and that's Barnett Wolf in 1955. Said the same thing, and he's been ignored as well. I mean, he was writing outside of epidemiology, so there's an excuse there. But he, if I go back on his words, they're identical to yours about numerator series, denominator series, and this kind of artifact is avoided if one works with incident rates in the two groups. Clear as day, you know. But he uses the funny genetics for small letters for numerators and capital letters for denominators.
Yeah.
And that, and then it's very clear. That paper, though, the 1976 paper, has a lot of material in it, and there are many gems in it, and I think some of them have indeed, I agree with you, some of them have been lost. If you had a chance to do that paper over again, would you do anything differently?
Yes. You already say that there is too much in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that effective writing really, I think, focuses on component topics one at a time instead of aggregating them the way it was done there. And that said, if I now imagine what really should have been the one and only theme at that time, it should have been this theme of let's move beyond case control study. Let's learn to be students of rates. Let's compare exposed with unexposed rather than cases with controls. And it is not an arbitrary option to compare, to do one thing or the other. You really must be committed to comparing the exposed with the unexposed as for rates. Comparing cases with controls is nonsense.
That paper also introduced one of the many terms that you brought into epidemiology, and that's the word incidence density. And I asked you recently why you felt the need to invent the term incidence density when others like Edmonds and Farr in the early 19th century were already using terms like rate and force of morbidity, force of mortality. What's wrong with something like event rate or transition rate? So do you want to repeat your answer here?
Let's first understand that we are talking about incidence rather than prevalence.
For sure.
Rate.
For sure.
But there is no singularity for incidence rate. There is a proportion type incidence, which is a dimensionless quantity like prevalence rate is. And then there is incidence density with its inverse time dimensionality. So it is a peculiar sub-concept under the concept of incidence rate. And so it needs a term that is more specific. Now, yes, I was, of course, well aware of force of morbidity, which is in that density mode, inverse time mode, no question. But why force? Now you could say force of incidence. Well, does that distinguish between this and the proportion type rate? And why force? I grew up largely, as you know, in statistics, and I have probability density as sort of a model. And in science at large, density is a very common concept. And so now we have incident phenomena, events, incidence rates are about events, not states.
Mm-hmm.
And so event density is...
Our event rate?
Well, but in the particular meaning of density. Because, as I say, proportion-type incidence is also a rate.
True.
So rate doesn't cut it with the appropriate specificity. You have to be specific density.
If I use the word transition rate, it would bring out the idea of sweeping over time.
Transition now refers to the fact that at issue is an event. Event is a transitional event.
Yeah.
But that, when you say transition rate, then I would just as well say event rate. But there are two kinds of event rate, the proportion type rate and then the density type rate in the inverse time sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I have no regrets about that.
Okay.
But that could have been another paper.
Yes. This term incidence density sampling is used a lot nowadays. What do you think of that?
I have not adopted that at all. Now, it probably has its origins in that 76 paper, but the whole point is that when your study base is population time, a dynamic population time, then you sample that for your denominator series. There's nothing special about the sampling itself. If there's anything special, it is the nature of the study base, namely a dynamic population. So that's what you are sampling.
Yes.
But it's not that you have a peculiar way of sampling.
Yeah.
You sample what you must sample.
Yeah. I have the same sense.
So it's not a sampling option.
I have the same sense that it's a misinterpretation.
Mm.
Yeah. What other terms did you bring into epidemiology, or is the list too long?
I'm afraid that the latter is the correct answer, but we are here, for instance, talking about comparisons, index category, reference category in the causal contrast. To be sure, is one of these, but...
Effect modification, is that yours?
Well, confounding is not a novelty of mine, but it was novelty to epidemiology when I introduced it. Of course, I drew it from Fisher as a term.
Yeah.
But in around 1970, still, in epidemiology, there was utter confusion between those two topics of confounding and modification. And I, in response to whatever other piece was topical at the time, I made that distinction between modification and confounding. And those terms, of course, have stuck. But I say again that the confounding is not an innovation of mine. It was established by Fisher.
Mm-hmm. Now, which of your contributions to the field would you most like to be remembered for?
There are people who think about how they are thought of posthumously. I am not one of those. I'm here and now, and I don't care what is thought or said afterwards. But if I should surmise as to what might be the subject of note in those posthumous days of mine, I really think that they would focus on the books that I've been working on for the last 2.5 years, really. Two books just came out, one on clinical epidemiology and EBM, and the other one, a counterpart of the Dictionary of Epidemiology. And right now I'm working on an introductory text on epidemiological research, and I expect to have that complete by the end of this year. And next year, I may still produce an introductory text on clinical research, which has been my other preoccupation in addition to epidemiological research. So I think that if there is any attention to the man when he's gone, it might center on these books, which really represent a synopsis of the understandings that I have achieved over the decades now, and focus really on what ultimately matters, namely the elementary. These are not advanced topics, any one of them, they are elementary.
Mm-hmm. Now, the book in particular that I'm struck by is the one Etymologic Research, Terms and Concepts. Is that the right term, the right title?
Quite so.
Yeah. And the arrangement of topics in that book is, to me, very interesting and appealing. And for those who haven't yet bought the book or seen the reviews or looked it up on Amazon, might you give us just a small preview of the contents there and the arrangement?
Yeah. Your questions have already brought up the issue of whether there are preliminaries that are necessary for entry into a line of study. Mm-hmm. For instance, if your study is physics, you surely must have a strong background in mathematics. Now, if your endeavor is going to be epidemiological research, as we know it, now you have certain preliminaries that you need to think about. There is terms and concepts of medicine for one, terms and concepts of science for another, and third, statistics. All these things, ideally, in an orientational way, are in the bag when you enter into your epidemiology studies. And so in that particular dictionary, if you want to think of it that way, there is a section for each of these preliminaries first. Mm-hmm. And then there is a section for actual epidemiological research. And then there is yet another section for something that I term meta-epidemiological clinical research. There's clinical research that is not of the epidemiological form, and there's clinical research that is of the epidemiological form, and that constitutes the fourth segment. And so I have endeavored to classify terms and concepts in these terms first, and then under the actual epidemiology and meta-epidemiological sections, I distinguish or try to distinguish between topics that have to do with object of study as distinct from methods of study. Because one of my big themes for years and years now has been the inattention in epidemiological research to object design. Everybody is a methodologist, study designer from the methods point of view, without any pride or even thought of being a designer of what to study exactly. And I might add that I have come to the view that the object design should lead you all the way to your statistical model, multivariate statistical model, so that so-called data analysis is no longer a topic I would care to teach, because most of it is covered under object design. And model fitting is today a minor exercise. And so object design versus methods design, an added distinction in those two sections. So it's the architecture that is quite unusual.
Just going back a little bit to another book, to your 1985 book, Theoretical Epidemiology, Principles of Occurrence Research in Medicine, what influence do you think it had? And, just that for the beginning.
It was not designed to be a textbook in teaching. I never, myself, in my extensive international teachings, had that as a textbook. Never. So it was sort of an expression of thoughts of the moment, heavy on statistics, for instance, over heavy by far for an introductory text. And so I did not intend it to be used in teaching. I never did that, as I just said. And I don't think that it has had any major impact. But as I said a moment ago, I think these current developments, mm-hmm. First of all, they are directed to teaching. and they are directed to introductory teaching, and if they don't have an impact, I will have been a failure. And that's what they will be saying posthumously, that Miettinen made an attempt, you know, around 2010, 12, whatever, he failed. So no, I don't think it had particular impact.
I'm okay. Yeah. Sure, they want more water?
It's okay for me.
Yeah. We're all set. So I'm struck by the what you said to me recently about the book you're planning on epidemiologic research, An Introduction. You mentioned to me in speaking that the material in this introductory book you're planning could also serve well outside of epidemiology. For example, in areas of research in criminology and psychology, even in other fields. And you seem to imply that the thinking in epidemiologic research was more advanced and more sophisticated than it's in many other fields. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that?
Well,
did I hear you right?
Yes, quite accurate. Let's take it that insofar as epidemiological research is research into the frequency of occurrence of a phenomenon, as this frequency depends on its determinants in a defined domain. If this is what is meant by epidemiological research, surely that phenomenon need not be a health phenomenon in a health domain. Surely it can be a matter of accidents occurring in highways. It can be a matter of misspellings in textbooks. The occurrence frequency concept, of course, covers a whole lot of any territory, whatever that you care to think about. Now, I am not justified, other than intuitively, saying that we in this health research business that we think of as epidemiological research, that we probably have had a stronger motive and a more serious effort to understand this research than people in linguistics, for example. But I don't know this. I'm just guessing.
Okay.
And I'm rather comfortable with that presumption, but I don't have justification. And so I'm just to agree that a student whose field is psychology, for instance, or criminology, or whatever, that they would do very well, in my opinion, coming to an epidemiology program and learning the ropes about the research in this way, and then going and doing their work in their particular field.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, other epidemiologists who have been interviewed for the series, for other epidemiologists who have been interviewed in the series, the focus has been on what makes for good epidemiologic research and good collaboration and collaborators. But I take it, and it's clear from what we've been saying, that you consider yourself first and foremost a developer and a teacher in the broadest sense of theoretical epidemiology. And so your readers will be interested in what you think makes a good teacher and your own assessment then of how well you've succeeded on this.
Yeah, I am a bit frustrated with the academic culture today where, when it comes to teaching, the mantra seems to be effectiveness of teaching, as though at issue were simply how well do you transmit your own understanding to your students. If I imagine myself again as a student in the early 60s, whom would I have liked to have as my teachers? Surely Nathan Mantel, for example, who by the prevailing criteria was an awful teacher, but by my criteria he would have been a deluxe teacher. R.A. Fisher, another statistician, you know, would not cut it by today's criteria, but gee whiz, what a privilege it would have been to be a student of R.A. Fisher. I'm saying that to me, the key regarding a teacher is for them to master their stuff. They may stutter and they may digress and whatever, But when you have a question, do you get the ultimate answer from this teacher? That, to me, is the touchstone. And in this way, I have endeavored over the years to really learn the stuff for myself. And then I don't pay a whole lot of attention to effectiveness of transmission, although I have a good deal of experience with that and have come to various ideas as to how to actually bring the student to the threshold of their own understanding. But again, key by far is mastery of your stuff rather than your technology of teaching.
Okay. Before we go on to the next main heading that the journal asked us to consider, I'd just like your views on a collection of different topics. Some of these you may want to say it's covered in one of the two books recently or so on, or you may want to expand here. So in no particular order, these are, I've one under the heading of odds ratios and logistic regression. Let me explain. If I understand you correctly, at one level, you think the 2x2 table and the odds ratio should be demoted or maybe even proscribed. And at another level, you are saying logistic regression should be promoted to be the single central regression method for all of etiologic, diagnostic, and prognostic research. Is that an accurate depiction of your views, and do you see any contradiction in what I'm saying?
Well, accurate it is, and no contradiction whatsoever. Mm. Let me say, when I was starting half a century ago, the 2x2 table was everywhere. And it was a disastrous misguidedness of teaching, where you sample from one margin and you have cohort study, and you sample from another margin and you have case control study, and you sample from the corner and you have cross-sectional study. Awful stuff. And here developed the preoccupation with odds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, logistic regression, of course, has on the left-hand side the logarithm of odds regarding the outcome event. The theory of logistic regression, of course, is impeccable as statistical theory. It hit epidemiology, by the way, in 1967.
62, with Cornfield.
What?
1962, with Cornfield.
I thought it was 67.
Formally in 67, yeah.
From Framingham.
Yeah, but he...
But it was based on discriminant function.
Yeah.
And the maximum likelihood approach came simultaneously. 67, in my mind.
Yeah, okay.
And so there it came with considerable force, and it was a welcome development. But the curious thing is that the case control study topic, once again. If you have a case series and a base series, now the odds, so to speak, is about caseness versus baseness.
Mm-hmm.
It is not caseness versus non-caseness. It is caseness versus baseness.
Mm-hmm.
And the logistic model applies to this probability ratio. After all you have in the left-hand side, on the left-hand side, is probability ratio.
Mm-hmm.
One is the complement of the other, but it need not be.
That's right.
So probability of caseness for a person moment versus probability of baseness for a person moment.
Mm-hmm.
And now you formulate that logistically, fine. There is no odds here whatsoever. If you have two incidence density formulations, numerator entry, denominator, numerator entry, denominator, there is no number of non-cases. There is just the cases and the base size, cases and the base size. And this is what the logistic is about in your etiologic study, and hence no conflict. And we should grow out of this business of reporting odds ratios from etiologic studies. Readers have no meaningful concept to go with that. They ought to learn to say rate ratio.
Yeah.
Rate ratio. That's all it is.
The next one is Bayesian analysis or Bayesian methods and their place, if any, in epidemiologic research. Your succinct views on that.
Bayesian statistics was brought to North America by Savage, having spent his sabbatical with Definiti in Italy. And what I saw Savage bringing more than anything else was the concept of subjective probability.